From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by your generous support, you, our listeners. We're very grateful for that support. Today, as the world around us changes in unsettling and unexpected ways, it's more important than ever to provide this platform for thoughtful, respectful dialogue and voices that all too often get unheard. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, February 5th is the Interfaith Four Chaplains Sunday, and the 11th brings the Jewish observance of Tu Bishvat. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, at least 17 Jewish community centers nationwide received bomb threats on Tuesday, leading to police response and some evacuations. This continues an awful trend that saw 30 Jewish institutions receiving bomb threats on January 18th and another wave on January 9th. 6 dead, 19 wounded in a tragic attack on a mosque in Quebec, Canada. Fox News tweeted that the suspect was of Moroccan origin and kept that tweet, which was retweeted over 900 times, kept it up until the Canadian Prime Minister's office asked it to be taken down because it was spreading misinformation. The actual attacker was a French-Canadian student who was a vocal supporter of far-right causes in Canada and France, as well as of Donald Trump. Muslim leaders in Quebec complained that a massive surge in attacks on Muslim targets has too rarely been reflected in hate crime statistics. Even as transgender Americans across the country rush to formalize identity documents in anticipation of assaults from the Trump administration on their dignity and safety, the Boy Scouts of America took a resolute step, officially accepting trans boys as scouts. And at the National Prayer Breakfast Thursday morning, the new president doubled down on a campaign promise to conservative Christians to totally destroy, his words, to totally destroy the Johnson Amendment. This long-standing rule prevents tax-exempt institutions, including churches, from endorsing political candidates. He called it a religious freedom issue, and it is, except that it's the Johnson Amendment that keeps things free and fair. Sad. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
When he first announced it, he said Muslim ban. He called me up. He said, put a commission together. Show me the right way to do it legally.
Protection of the nation from foreign terrorist entry into the United States. We all know what that means.
It's hard to muster people to respond to something as outrageous as the new administration's Muslim ban. Harder still is maintaining that outrage as days turn into weeks and new outrages keep coming. We'll get a look at what Muslim advocacy has been like under these conditions from Catherine Orsborn, campaign director at Shoulder to Shoulder.
Americans should not take the current international order for granted. It did not will itself into existence. We created it. Likewise, it is not naturally self-sustaining. We have sustained it. If we stop doing so, it will fray and eventually collapse.
Former CIA Director General David Petraeus is only one of many national security experts to be sounding the alarm about the extreme dangers being created by the new administration's policies. Hundreds of State Department officials have signed memos of protest. Yes, we're in an age where experience and expertise seem to be disrespected as ever before, but I, for one, am not ready to buy into the age of ignorance. And so later this hour, we'll call on the deep knowledge of Ken Goode, Senior Fellow for National Security and Terrorism at the Center for American Progress. But first,
I think in Gorsuch, the president has chosen a diamond.
Well, I'll tell you, I think Judge Gorsuch is a home run. I am very, very happy.
It's not the justice job to play favorites. It's to call the balls and strikes.
Judge Neil Gorsuch, that's the name the president unveiled this week as his pick for the Merrick Garland seat on the Supreme Court. We were lucky enough to have author and attorney Rabbi Jay Michelson with us when President Obama nominated Judge Garland, and he's back with us today. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, Jay. What was your first reaction when you heard the president's choice for his Supreme Court nominee?
Well, yeah, thanks, Walton, for having me back. My first reaction was, well, this is payback for the conservative Christian right, which put Trump in office.
Sure.
You know, there's kind of a misconception out there that the president just ran purely on the so-called white working class and all that kind of resentment. But actually, the largest block of voters for him were white evangelicals, conservatives. And it's not a secret why they did that. They voted for social issues, for Mike Pence, and for the Supreme Court. And so by choosing someone who was by far the most kind of pro-life, I think, explicitly of any of the finalists, with the possible exception of Judge Pryor, you know, the president's sending a message. It's payback time.
Well, at least there's a clear and direct track record for this nominee on issues of religious liberty. I wish you'd talk about his involvement in the Hobby Lobby and Little Sisters cases, if you would.
This is the guy who wrote one of the Hobby Lobby opinions at the circuit court level that then got sent up to the Supreme Court. Actually wrote an opinion that was more favorable to Hobby Lobby than the eventual Supreme Court opinion. So, you know, especially in light of the fact there are rumors going around now that we're about to see a huge national religious exemption executive order. You know, you and I have been talking about the religious exemption strategy for several years. It's now at the absolute highest levels. And this is someone who is, you know, the judicial equivalent of that executive order. I mean, this is someone who believes there should be extremely broad religious exemptions. And the Hobby Lobby opinion is one of those. He's also involved in the Little Sisters of the Poor case, which is the case that said if you sign no on a form, that means you're actually signing yes. And he endorsed that logic. So Judge Gorsuch seems, from all accounts, to be a very brilliant jurist, also very ethical, but extremely conservative, well to the right of the mainstream on religious and social issues.
Remind our listeners the principle at stake in Hobby Lobby and the principle at stake in Little Sisters.
Narrowly, Hobby Lobby was about Obamacare and contraception and whether a private corporation could exempt itself from paying the insurance coverage that might be one day used for contraception. But what it was more broadly about was whether corporations are people for the perspective of religion, which the court decided that they are, and whether they're entitled to exemptions from laws of general application. So I'll just give you another example that has nothing to do with Obamacare. Suppose the folks at Hobby Lobby say to an employee of theirs who has a same-sex partner, you know, legally married, we're not going to pay your wife or husband's health insurance because we have a religious objection to that. You know, under the logic of Hobby Lobby and the rumored executive order, that would be perfectly legal. So, you know, it starts to look a lot like separate but unequal when you have a marriage that doesn't have to be respected by others. So narrowly, Hobby Lobby was about Obamacare, and now, of course, that contraception provision is going to be taken out entirely. But more broadly, it's about the fact that corporations are people, corporations are religious people, and corporations can use their religious beliefs to discriminate against others.
So what else do we need to know about this nominee that you know?
If the Republicans hadn't trashed the confirmation process last year with Judge Garland, this is someone who should be confirmed, because what it used to be was that if it's a qualified jurist and somebody of satisfactory ethical standards, you don't look to his ideology or her ideology. You know, the trouble is that last year we had an extremely competent, perfectly qualified judge that many Republicans liked and endorsed and had voted for earlier, who didn't even get a hearing, let alone a floor vote. So now the rules are different, and there are many who are calling for the Democrats to say, well, all right, we're going to approve Judge Gorsuch because he's such a good guy. Well, Judge Garland was also a good guy, and so now we're in a different zone where if Democrats were to approve Judge Gorsuch, they would be rewarding the unprecedented and oath-defying behavior of congressional Republicans, Senate Republicans last year.
Jay, in the second half of this last week, sources that we know and trust published leaked information on proposed pro-discrimination legislation that's really nothing short of breathtaking. You're an expert on religious exemptions, so what are your thoughts on this development?
Well, the fact that it has not yet been released, at least as we're having this conversation, gives me a little bit of hope that maybe White House counsel is reviewing the executive order. The terms of the order are very similar to a law that passed in Mississippi and that was later ruled unconstitutional. So maybe this delay is an indicator that they're thinking it over. What they have on the table, what we've seen, the leaked document that Sarah Posner found and published for The Nation, is indeed breathtaking. It is the end of LGBT equality as we know it. And as you know, we've known each other a long time. I'm not prone to exaggeration or hysteria. But when you allow any government agency, any corporation, any organization, and any individual to disregard somebody's gender identity because of a religious belief, to disregard somebody's marital status because of a religious belief. And then, you know, some of the sneaky bits in there, too. It's just also, well, I think sex before marriage is my religious belief, so therefore I won't do business with unmarried couples, which will include same-sex couples because I don't view their marriage as legitimate either. You know, you really are talking about a regime of separate but unequal where my marriage, speaking personally, would have no value. Where any adoption agency in the country, even if it gets 100% of its funding from the government, can simply refuse to place a child with me, where any corporation can refuse to serve me. And this is not just turning back the clock. I mean, this would be the most significant anti-LGBT and also anti-women executive order really in history.
Jay, you're one of the few people in the world I think can answer this question. There are many Americans who supported Donald Trump who are now dismayed, disappointed, and some of them afraid. And yet, it's really, really hard to admit you've changed your mind in a situation like this. So, Jay, rabbi, writer, teacher, attorney, how do we help? How do those of us who saw this disaster coming make it easier for those former supporters to break away and put patriotism ahead of partisanship?
Well, it's a really interesting question. Speaking for myself, I actually am planning to stand aside. I don't think there's anything that I can really do as someone who's a progressive and who's spoken on this sort of thing for many years. You know, I don't have a whole lot of credibility. And I think this is something that conservatives need to come to on their own. You know, there was a blog post last week that went viral by a security hawk on the Lawfare blog, which is a mostly center-right conservative security hawk blog, saying why the ban on travel for people from Muslim countries was such a terrible idea, not because he was a bleeding-heart liberal and was upset about Muslims, but because he's a security hawk and was upset about what this would do to American security interests. You know, that kind of argument is, I think, the most important as there builds a conservative groundswell against Trump and a moderate groundswell. That's really important. And so I think, you know, what can we do to help? In a certain way, it's to stand aside and let the conservative community lead on this. But I will say, you know, it's interesting. There's one group that hasn't really been crying and gnashing its teeth, and that has been the Christian right, the institutional Christian right of conservative evangelicals, conservative Catholics, because they've gotten everything they've wanted. They've gotten several cabinet appointments that are pushing that agenda. They're going to get this executive order. They have the Supreme Court justice. And, you know, they've been willing to look the other way on just about everything, alienating our allies in Mexico and Australia, corrupting the National Security Council by putting a warmongering, inexpert, crazy, paranoid person, Steve Bannon, on the NSC. So far, they've been willing to look the other way as long as they get what they want on social issues. And I worry that from the religious point of view, things are going to have to get a lot worse before that community also comes around to regret their support of Trump.
And, you know, all they had to do to get all of that in their pockets was sell their souls.
That's right. That was it. And I think, you know, I'm hopeful Trump's speech at the National Prayer Breakfast, which was really obscene, right? I mean, just like his speech at the launch of Black History Month, you know, to get up at the National Prayer Breakfast, which is a rare moment of solidarity and unity, and to make jokes that we should be praying for Arnold Schwarzenegger because the ratings on The Apprentice are so low. I mean, it's fine. We all know Trump is a narcissist, right? But that's blasphemy, right? I mean, he is at a national prayer breakfast with sincere religious believers, and he's basically making about his television show and his ratings. I mean, that is outrageous that people of faith have to really ask themselves, all right, it's fine. All right, he didn't know it was 2 Corinthians instead of 2 Corinthians. Okay, he's a serial adulterer who's had a number of affairs and brags about assaulting women. But where is the line? Insulting the prayer breakfast, making a joke out of the national prayer breakfast? To me, I scratch my head and I wonder, you know, what's this guy going to have to do in order to alienate people of faith enough that they say, you know, this really isn't worth it? Especially, look, with Vice President Pence waiting in the wings, President Pence obviously would be just as socially conservative as the Trump administration. So, you know, they wouldn't lose by abandoning Trump. You just have to wonder, is there a line that he can cross? Or if they're really willing to just put up with absolutely anything, including blasphemy at the prayer breakfast.
Dr. J. Michelson wears at least 2 hats. He is a rabbi, meditation teacher. He's a leading writer on contemporary spirituality, whose latest book is The Gate of Tears, Sadness and the Spiritual Path, a book that I have been rereading over the last 3 weeks. Jay's also an attorney who served as a law clerk to Judge Merrick Garland. Thank you for being with us again, Jay, on State of Belief.
Thank you, Elton. And unfortunately, I look forward to you renaming the show State of Disbelief, given what's going on in our country. But keep doing what you do. Really appreciate it.
As the news for lovers of true religious freedom in this country went from bad to worse, I knew this was a week that I just had to talk with my next guest, heading up the effective shoulder-to-shoulder campaign, an interfaith organization dedicated to ending anti-Muslim sentiment. Catherine Orsborn, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Welton. Thanks for having me on.
How much of a shock was it when this Muslim ban was abruptly put into effect? Did you see it coming?
You know, I can't say it was a total shock. The rhetoric on the campaign trail and seeing some of the folks that Trump was putting in high positions of authority in the administration, I felt, and I think many folks that I work with felt, that we were going to see some pretty bad stuff come down the pipe. I think what was surprising was how quickly it came down and how little pushback there seemed to be from within. So that piece of it, I think, was shocking in certain ways. But I think, you know, the overall content of it, you know, I and a lot of folks working on these issues felt that something like that was going to come out sooner or later, because we had learned not to write off the rhetoric from the campaign trail.
Yeah. I'm sure you've worked directly with people impacted by the ban and the way it was implemented. What's that been like?
It's been really, really chaotic, which I think we've seen in some of the news coverage of it. There's just so many people directly affected by it. I've heard a number of stories from friends. A Syrian friend whose aunt lives here, has been in the U.S. for 20 years and can't get back. She's stuck. A friend whose parents are stuck in France, even though they live in the United States, they're having trouble getting back. They have legal immigration status, in fact. Different folks who have family members that they're not going to be able to visit anytime soon, folks who have been trying to get here for medical emergencies, and the whole thing is chaotic. Folks don't quite know what to expect because it feels like a lot of the pieces are being dealt with on a case-by-case basis, so it's impossible to sort of be clear on what to expect here. And you know, I know a lot of folks who have been in time at airports, and it's been amazing to see the response of volunteer lawyers, along with the many, many activists and organizers who have been involved in that, who have spent so much of their time working with families and individuals that are getting caught in this already. So I'm just hearing so many appalling, alarming, and heartbreaking stories of families and individuals who are directly affected by this and didn't see it coming.
Are there specific dynamics that you're seeing that come from Muslim American families across the country being affected by this?
Even folks who aren't seeing a direct impact of, you know, say one of their family members or somebody being caught up in all of this. I think the other piece of this is a Muslim ban by another name, criminalizing people based on their national origin and really based on their faith. Because if there are exceptions for religious minorities, then it's not fully about national origin. It is about their Muslim identity. And I think that the message that sends is that Muslims are less American and less welcome in the United States. And so even American Muslim families that don't have, you know, a direct connection with somebody who is affected by that particular executive order, there's one, a very symbolic statement there, and we've seen people who harbor a lot of hate for Muslims acting on that in the past few weeks, with a mosque being burned down and you know, waves of hate crimes happening. You know, a lot of folks feel like this is the beginning, or maybe not quite the beginning, the middle in some ways of a slippery slope into more and more criminalization of people based on their Muslim identity.
The Shoulder to Shoulder campaign is promoting the United Against Muslim Ban initiative. Catherine, talk with us about this initiative.
Some of our partners came up with it to sort of collate and collect all these different opportunities and resources for folks who are wanting to take action against this. We've seen so many people coming out wanting to take action, and right now, if you're a lawyer, it's easy in some ways, because you can get to an airport and help directly with some of that. But a lot of other folks, you know, aren't quite sure where to plug in, or they want to understand a bit more background on this and understand exactly what's going on. And so folks created the United Against Muslim Ban site to try to help direct some of that energy into the various efforts happening. And I think this is an outcome of the fact that there's been so many networks and coalitions of folks responding to this very strongly. And because there's so much going on, it gets a little confusing for folks who are wanting to plug in about, you know, how do they do that? And so that was the point of this particular website. But I think also to show the broad base of voices speaking out against this from the business community, from the military, clearly from the faith communities all across the board. We've seen folks from Jewish, Protestant, Evangelical, Catholic, Muslim, and Sikh, and so many other faith communities really speaking out loudly about this, both with their words and with their feet, by showing up to different demonstrations and all sorts of things. And so the United Against Muslim Ban campaign, you know, one, it's a website where you can find information about how to take action, but it's also showing the loudness of these collective voices from so many different sectors and walks of life speaking out against this, because this is really not portraying who we are as Americans and what we want our nation to exhibit and to be.
Would you just give us an illustration of what are some individual actions that you are suggesting that concerned Americans engage in?
I think one of the top line items that everyone should be doing is contacting their elected officials. That is something that people can do every single day, to call preferably. If you can't call, to contact by email or Facebook, or, you know, showing up in their office, in their district office if you can, to make sure that, especially if you have Republican representation in your district, to be making sure they're hearing from people who stand against this. That's one piece. And then there's, of course, a number of petitions and different ways of trying to collect those voices together, speaking out in other ways, whether it's through op-eds or letters to the editor. That's also an important way that folks can be listing their voices. And then over the last week, we've been promoting people of faith taking action by lifting up these issues in their own houses of worship, whether that's through, you know, a Sunday school class or a sermon or something like that, but making sure that these issues are being discussed within your own faith community, taking the time then to show your support for Muslims and for refugees in your area by writing letters of support, and sending them to communities in your area to have a big showing of Americans who are standing together with our Muslim neighbors and saying that this is not who we want to be. We're stronger when we're together and we're standing with one another. So I think it's always a combination of showing publicly your solidarity, building those relationships, and organizing and taking political action.
Catherine, how optimistic or pessimistic are you about what we're up against in the next 4 years? Are we likely to recognize our nation when this is all over?
You know, that's a tough question for me right now. I've been really trying to hold on to hope in a lot of ways, and I think that's, you know, where I find faith and hope is in really hoping that the American people continue to step up and push back, and really hoping that other elected officials can continue to step up and push back and to do that more and more boldly. I am pessimistic about what we're going to see coming from the administration. Mm-hmm. I think that we're going to continue to see bad stuff coming from the administration, even when huge numbers of Americans are pushing back. But what gives me hope is all of the organizing that's happening, all of the groups at grassroots levels, as well as at political levels, that are really taking this seriously and organizing and pushing back against things that are tearing away at our Constitution, tearing away at our American ideals and our communities, creating more insecurity in the United States, creating more uncertainty here. I think the folks that are coming together at so many different levels to try to push back against that, I'm hopeful that we can make a difference by continuing that pushback and by sticking with it. I think that's what's going to allow us to see our country intact in several years. But I mean, I'm not optimistic about what we're going to be seeing from the administration. Yeah. I'm hopeful, but I'm not optimistic about that.
You know, it's so heartwarming to have people stand in solidarity with their neighbors, as has been happening in the last several days. One of the most memorable of the many signs from the women's marches were variations on that old language, quote, first they came for the Muslims, now, and I said, not this time. This is going to take sustaining action with a lot of stamina required. How do we keep that up?
Well, I think that what I've seen so far is really taking care of each other, watching out for each other, and trying to help recognize when we need to step back and take breathers in order to keep ourselves sane, and when we need to help other people to do that as well. So being looking out for the people that you're working with, that you're organizing with, that you're in solidarity with, and checking in with each other. And none of us can do this 100% at 100% effort 100% of the time. It's just not possible. And so I think, you know, where folks can find spiritual and emotional sustenance, whatever that looks like for you, but really prioritizing building that into our lives, because for us to continue in this movement, pushing back, you know, it's going to be a long road, and it has been a long road, and I know so many have been on this long road for so long, and I think all of them would say that taking care of yourself and trying to help take care of other people is really important for continuing.
Catherine Osborne is Campaign Director for Shoulder to Shoulder, an effective interfaith advocacy organization that's at the forefront of advancing the liberty and justice for all that's promised in our founding documents, with a focus on Muslim Americans. Catherine, you do such great work. Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here with you.
We don't really need national security experts to tell us that attacking a major world religion is no way to increase the stability of an already volatile world. But because this logic seems to escape many of our current leaders and some of their supporters as well, I wanted to take a little time to look at the potential fallout of the path our policy seems now to be on. Joining me is Ken Goode, Senior Fellow for National Security and Terrorism at the Center for American Progress. Ken, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for having me on. Glad to be here.
Would you start, please, with just a simple summary of what's wrong with the path the new administration is heading down in terms of national security?
Well, look, I think when we're talking about this executive order that has banned immigration to the United States from seven mostly Muslim countries and suspended the refugee program for 120 days and from Syria indefinitely, what we see is an effort to shut the door out on the world, and particularly the Muslim world, that will have very real-world implications. In the near term, we're very concerned that it will complicate a critical relationship that the United States is counting on to fight against ISIS on the ground, and that's the relationship with Iraq. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of U.S. soldiers and advisors there in Iraq right now, and Iraq was one of the countries that the United States has banned from coming to the U.S. Their parliament passed a reciprocal ban, and the relationship now, that partnership in the fight against ISIS, is really in doubt, and that is troubling. But more longer term, what we're concerned about is that this kind of approach, this we're going to shut down Muslim immigration, we're going to turn our backs on the Muslim world, will feed an ability of our adversaries to recruit new followers into their ranks, because it, in a way, validates their message that the United States and the West are at war with Muslims and Islam. And that is a development that will have, I think, very negative consequences for the security of the United States.
What concerns you the most about how policy is being made right now, if indeed there is any logic to the way policy is being made, if it's being made at all?
Well, what's concerning the most so far is that it appears that the people around the president and his tight inner circle are pushing aside the traditional mechanisms of the U.S. government, the National Security Career Civil Service and Foreign Service, and other parts of the government that exist to serve presidents of both parties. And instead, they are making these decisions with very little input, even from their own senior cabinet secretaries. And this very small circle is dictating U.S. policy across the government, and we see how difficult it is to then implement this policy in any kind of rational and coherent way, because so few people have been involved in the decision-making process. And we saw that, of course, this past weekend with the chaos and uncertainty at the airports about exactly how this latest order would be implemented. And if once we get beyond decisions like that, if we find ourselves in a genuine crisis situation, that decision-making process of shunning the traditional mechanisms of government and having a small group try to dictate U.S. policy across the government, I think that is deeply concerning if we are confronted with a situation where we have a provocation or a crisis, say, that erupts in the Middle East.
This past week, we have seen a lot of disturbing things take place as the president talked with leaders from other nations, talking in a way to offend people with whom we have had great relationships across the years. You deal with this professionally and intellectually all of the time. What are your feelings when you see all that happen?
I'm deeply worried, and I wish that I could say that it isn't something that keeps me up at night and concerns me, but learning about the confrontations that the president has gotten into with really core U.S. allies and partners over things that should just not lead to the level of confrontation that they have, whether it's this spat with Mexico's president or hanging up on the Australian prime minister. I mean, these are America's allies and friends and partners, and they have been with the United States, with us for decades across political transitions and transitions in administration from one party to the next and in different global security environments. These are the people who have been with the United States, and the president is starting off getting in significant fights and confrontations with them. Mm-hmm. And I think we can probably count on our allies to be with us for a while, but I'm worried that if we continue down this road of antagonizing our friends and undermining the alliance structure that we have built, there will come a point when our allies just say enough is enough. Their own domestic politics will dictate to them that they aren't able to engage with the United States in the terms that we have come to expect. And that becomes a real problem when the chips are down, when we're in a confrontation, when we're in a crisis. And, you know, no administration can go 4 years without having some situation arise in the international sphere that is a genuine crisis. And I am deeply concerned that when that time comes for the Trump administration, we won't have our friends with us. We won't have our allies at our back. And we'll be facing down these threats in this situation all on our own.
Large numbers of State Department officials and other experts have come out strongly in opposition to these policies. How sustainable is that kind of protest? And also, because the press secretary has already said, in effect, if you don't like it, get out, are we going to be left with no real experts at all in a month or two?
Well, I think the resilience of the career officials in the government is going to be tested over the coming weeks and months. And you know, I think the reaction that we've seen over just this first 2 weeks of the Trump presidency and is in some ways encouraging in that they are these official channels through which they can voice their official objections to the policies that are being put in place by the new administration. But there will come a time when many of them will just be fed up with what is going on, and I am concerned about the potential for a serious flight of expertise and experience from the U.S. government. And if that happens, you know, then we will be left with the true loyalists to the Trump team, and certainly their performance so far does not give us great confidence.
Ken, how concerned are you about the likelihood of more so-called unforced errors in the weeks ahead?
Yeah, you know, that is a big concern. This is an inexperienced team. We just had Secretary of State confirmed Rex Tillerson. He seems to be an accomplished person, but he has never served in any capacity in the government before or in a diplomatic role. And he has a very big and tough job on his hands to try and relate to the world when you have as volatile a president as we do. And, you know, in his confirmation hearing, he made a number of unforced errors, drawing a red line in the South China Sea against the Chinese that the United States has no capacity to enforce. So what happens when that is tested? His relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin is extremely well known. What we're seeing right now with Russian involvement in Ukraine and ramping up their attacks by pro-Russian rebels has been met with utter silence from the Trump administration. What is going to happen when we see the Iranians react to the statement by the National Security Advisor putting them on notice, whatever that means? So we're kind of stumbling here into a number of potential crises, and you know, we're still in very early days of this administration. So it is very concerning.
Would you suggest for our listeners what they need to be paying particularly close attention to going forward?
Well, I think the most important thing is to pay attention to what is emanating out of this core group in the White House. What's coming from the president himself, what Steve Bannon is saying and doing, and what the National Security Advisor, Mike Flynn, is saying and doing. And don't be distracted by some soothing comments by a cabinet secretary. It's clear the White House is running this show. And as a consequence of that, the real power and decision-making process is there, and that's what we should be paying attention to. And the one thing that we have seen in the last 2 weeks is that there has been a very high level of activism among the American people that are concerned about some of the activities that have already taken place. Obviously, the protests around the bans at the airports have been having an effect. So, too, has been efforts on the part of people around the country to contact their members of Congress and their senators to express their views. So I would say to your listeners, pay attention to what's happening in the White House and call your representatives. Be active. Don't just sit back and let this happen, because we have the ability as a country and as an active citizenry to express our views to our members of Congress and to the senators and get them to try and be a meaningful check on what's happening in the White House.
Ken Good is Senior Fellow for National Security and Terrorism at the Center for American Progress. Ken, I really do appreciate you taking time to be with us. I have the sense that we're going to need to hear your voice many more times as we make our way through this. And we're really pleased to have you on State of Belief Radio, and we look forward to being with you again.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Weldon, and keep up what you're doing. It's critical work. Thank you.
Before we go, just an important reminder. We're about to see a fierce and divisive debate take place over President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court. We're going to hear a lot about the nominee's position on religious freedom. Knowing that the tarry debate is coming, I want to offer some words of preparation and warning that might be helpful to you. Repeatedly in my writings, speeches, and commentaries on State of Belief, I have said that we are now facing the most hostile and powerful threats to alter or eliminate religious freedom that we have seen since the adoption of the First Amendment to the Constitution. The background of, and my reasons for, a stark and serious warning come from my eyewitness observance of a movement led primarily by Catholic bishops and many evangelical Christians to change the meaning of the First Amendment. That strategy already has had success in weakening the two religion clauses in the First Amendment that clearly define what religious freedom means. Just prior to introducing his nominee for a seat on the Supreme Court, President Trump, who has demonstrated clearly that he has no idea of what religious liberty means, said pointedly to evangelical Christians that they were going to be very pleased with his nominee. Later, he remarked that his candidate for the High Court was noted for his support of religious freedom. Now, let me stop right there and ask the question, what kind of religious freedom has this judge supported? Is it the freedom defined in the First Amendment, or a fake and distorted religious freedom as propagated by those seeking religious freedom for themselves that offers little to no real religious freedom for people in other religions or people who hold to no religion? What I've been warning about in recent years has now been overtly placed in the public square for Americans to embrace or reject. Judge Neil Gorsuch, who supposedly holds a textual approach to the Constitution, affirmed the Hobby Lobby case that, for the first time in history, treated corporations as individuals. Gorsuch also, again, contrary to prior rulings based on the First Amendment, turned the freedom of religion into a tool for fostering discrimination. Now, those rulings strike me as much closer to the propaganda of those who want to do away with religious freedom than the application of the First Amendment that protects freedom for all individuals and remains the cornerstone of democracy. The debate will be heated. The political fight will be nasty. Please, please pay close attention. When you hear the words support for religious freedom, by all means ask what kind of religious freedom is being talked about. That freedom resident in the First Amendment to the Constitution that discriminates against no person or religion, or that popular pseudo-form of freedom peddled by people glorifying only religious freedom for themselves. Ask hard questions, and don't stop until you have satisfactory answers. Religious freedom was meant for everybody, not just for one or two brands of Christians or as a convenience for discriminatory corporations. Remember, religious freedom never was meant to support any kind of discrimination. The old dog-eared, well-worn phrase from a century ago is still as relevant as I speak as it was when it was first spoken. Eternal vigilance is the price of freedom. My friends, the battle for real freedom is underway. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We're counting on you. We're counting on you now more than ever. And quite frankly, so are many listeners who aren't able to find the voices that we amplify week after week anywhere else. If you've heard something that you found to be helpful, I urge you to share it with others who might also benefit from hearing it. It's really easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter. Direct your friends to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and in-depth archives, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. That's stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. Be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. And until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.